they wanted to continue. He was not here last
I
week.
I was not here.
You were here last week. You were here last week.
Oh.
I just remember. They're so full. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. So we decided that we wanted to do a little bit more. I don't exactly remember where we left off in the middle of column. So we'll kind of relook.
Right.
Don't have any notes. No, did they
385. It's 385.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Shabbos was 311.
Yeah. Sorry.
I put January 6th here, and I thought, no, I must have been wrong, because I didn't think that it was the 13th.
Yeah,
well, 6 and 7 is 13th.
I know.
Right.
Crazy,
but I just didn't think I was right.
It's the middle of the month. Yeah. Okay, so the mitzvah of challah, we're going to do challah and tzitzis today, hopefully. Mm. So we'll just do a little bit on challah and most on tzitzis. So the mitzvah of challah is to separate a part of the dough when we make it. This mitzvah applies only in the land of Israel. On a diraisa level. So let's just review those two vocabulary words, diraisa or diraita, if you're a soft person instead of a tough person, and dirabanan. So diraisa means it's of biblical origin, dirabanan means it's of rabbinic origin. So the diraisa mitzvah is only applies in the land of Israel. The dirabanan mitzvah applies outside the land of Israel as well. So that's why we still do it today. But it doesn't actually apply today. And another aspect of it doesn't apply either, and that's the giving to the Kohen of that piece of dough. So the whole point of separating the challah is to be able to sustain our teachers, the Kohanim, in their service. They don't have a portion of the land of Israel. They don't have their own agriculture. So therefore, they need to be sustained by us. We sustain them, and they sustain us with their teaching. That's what challah is about, is sustaining them. Challah is considered in the category of truma. A long time ago, we looked at the different Kohanic gifts that we give, trumot and ma'asrot, the tithes and the trumas, the offerings. Challah is a truma. One of the things about truma is that there is no amount that you have to give. So there are some measures, but there's no actual minimum. So the same thing with challah, there's no actual minimum. However, there is a minimum for giving. There's not a minimum for taking. So what I mean by that is there's two aspects in the taking of challah. When we take challah from our dough, we make our dough. It starts, right? The mitzvah starts to apply once we've kneaded water into the dough. It doesn't apply to flour, it applies to dough. Once we've kneaded it, that's when the mitzvah applies. So how much do we need to remove from our dough in order to be able to eat our dough? That's question number one. And question number two is, how much do we need to remove from our dough to be able to give to the Kohen? Right? It's two separate questions, right? So it seems that the halachic measurement and the measurement that's listed here in the Sefer Chinuch is that you're supposed to give, that's the amount, how much dough is necessary. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have to give 1/24 of your dough to the Kohen. Unless you're a baker, in which case you can give 1/48 of your dough, because you have a lot of dough. Right, so that's the amount. Today, that's not what we do, because we're not giving to a Kohen. We're going to burn it or discard it, so we do not have to. All you have to give is a speck. Mm. That's it. Well, all you have to take is a speck, right? So like truma, there is no minimum amount. So if you have a whole field of wheat, all you have to take is one grain of wheat, and then your field of wheat is no longer tevel. Remember, we learned the word tevel. Tevel means nothing has been separated from it yet, and therefore you can't eat it. So your dough will be tevel, or your field will be tevel, if you haven't taken anything from it yet. So one grain of wheat for truma, or one speck of dough for challah, works to make it not tevel, and therefore you can eat it. Will that take care of your mitzvah of giving it to the Kohen? No, it will not. But we don't have that mitzvah today. We don't have that capacity today. So all we need to do is take one little speck from our dough today in order to make the dough edible, but not in order to fulfill the mitzvah of giving to the Kohen. If we were going to give that dough to the Kohen, that's when we need the 1/24. So today, we don't usually take a speck. We usually take a small amount. But there is no amount. Don't let anybody tell you you have to take an egg's worth or a ball worth. There's no amount. There is not. You just have to take something. So usually we take like around, let's say, a golf ball size. Just a piece that looks like a piece, not a speck. You don't need, you know, take a fingernail full, but you could. A fingernail full would do the trick. All you have to do is take something. And then you burn it or double wrap it and discard it. So that piece of dough has kedusha. That piece of dough is a kohanic offering. Even though we can't give it to a kohen, it is holy and it goes to a kohen and can only be eaten by a kohen who's tahor. So in some places, according to the chinuch, at some times, they would give this portion of dough to young kohanim, who are not yet tamei mate, or tamei in other ways. but they don't do that today. That's not done. We just burn it or discard it. So, and even in the land of Israel, although we have discussed before when we talked about Trumot and Masrot, because in the land of Israel, people really do have to separate the full tithes from their produce, not just from their doughs, but from their produce. What do we do with that? We don't want to waste all that food. Some is redeemed on coins, that's permitted to be redeemed, and some cannot be redeemed. So you have leftover fruits and vegetables, and you don't want to waste all that. So it's given to the biblical zoo. All those animals are owned by Kohanim, so they're all Kohanic animals, and they can eat it. Because they don't have to be tahor to eat it. But humans do. So that's how they don't waste the food, is allow those animals to be owned by Kohanim. Okay, so we discussed last time also, so let's just review this a little bit. There is a machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban as to how many mitzvahs this is. The Sefer Chinuch, as you know, paskins according to the Rambam, Maimonides. So his count goes according to Maimonides. Again, we all agree there's 613 mitzvot, and different people have different counts as to what they are. So the Rambam says it makes no sense. The Rambam says this is one mitzvah, taking chal. The Ramban says it makes no sense that this should be one mitzvah. It should be two. One for taking, one for separating, and one for giving to the Kohen. It's two separate acts. It doesn't make sense that this should be one mitzvah. It's really two different things. And the proof is that the bracha that we say on it is lahafrish chala min ha'isa. There's actually three different possibilities for the bracha. One is lahafrish truma, to take truma. They actually call the chala a truma. Or, in the Shulchan Aruch, it says lahafrish chala, and there's a yesh omrim, there's a those that say the bracha should include the final two words, which is what our custom is today, lahafrish chala min ha'isa, from the dough, to separate chala from the dough. So that's how most people say it today, lahafrish chala min ha'isa. That's what you say, right? Min ha'isa. So there's those three possibilities of brachas, but that's the last one, is the one that most of us say. So separating it is one thing unto itself, and even a kohen who makes dough has to separate, but they get to keep it. Right? They don't have to give it to a kohen because they are a kohen, but they still have to separate it, which shows that it's a separate mitzvah to separate it. Doesn't have to actually do with the giving, the separating. There's really two separate things.
So they don't have to burn it.
They don't have to burn it. Oh, no. A Kohen who's tahor and can eat it does not have to burn it. That's correct. No, nobody would have to burn it. It's only burned today in Chutzlar. It's when we can't give it to a Kohen.
It's not burned in Israel?
It's only burned when we're doing it Durabun and we can't give it to a Kohen. Okay. In Israel, I mean, I wonder what Angel Bakery does when they separate challah. Do they give it to the biblical zoo? Maybe they do. You know, or do they just burn it? I don't know. But some place like that, they may end up giving whatever it is to the biblical zoo.
So in the land, it's deraisa. Out of the land, it's derabanan.
Correct.
Correct?
It has to be in the land with the bulk of the Jews living there. So it's, okay. We're not quite there yet. We don't have the majority of the planet's Jews. So Israel is now the largest Jewish community in the world, but it's still not the majority of the Jews. So it used to be the United States was the largest Jewish community because we had approximately 6 million. We have less than 6 million now, and Israel has more than 6 million now, but it's still not, that's not the majority of the Jews, because we have around 14-ish million in the world. So once Israel hits 7.1 million, then a lot of other mitzvahs will kick in Israel. It will be Diraisa.
Yeah.
Because then you'll have the majority of the Jews living in the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that will make a difference when it happens. We're getting there. A few more people making Aliyah. France is emptying out. Anti-Semites are helping with that. Yeah,
Russia and France are both.
Russia brought a lot of non-Jews into Israel. A lot.
Oh, did they really?
A lot. A lot of those Jews, a lot of the people who immigrated to Israel were not Jewish. Some because they were married to Jews, some because they were related. There's a lot of economic immigration with the Russian immigrants of the last, 30 years. A lot of economic opportunity. Russia stunk. Nobody likes Israel's much better.
It still stinks, yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's not as bad now as it was.
No, it's not as bad, but
then.
It's still not a great place to be. Yeah.
And Israel was nothing like it is today either, at all, 30 years ago. It was not nearly as comfortable. Today it's very comfortable.
Right.
30 years ago it was not so comfortable, but it was more comfortable than Russia. So everybody wanted to go, so a lot went.
And the persecution was so high.
Yeah, right. So whoever could get out of Russia, Israel is much better.
I understand.
So, a lot went, but a lot weren't Jewish. A lot aren't Jewish. And it's a real problem today. It's a problem with burials. It's a problem with the army service. It's a problem with marriages. What do you do? What do you do with a Russian Gentile who served in the Israeli army and was killed? Where do you bury him? In the military cemetery? No, because he's not Jewish. So, do you make a separate military? I don't know what they've done. Do you know if they have a separate military cemetery?
Mm-hmm. Did they bury them along the fence or something?
I don't know. They have separate places. It's really a problem. And really investigating lineage. And yet they died for Israel. They died al Kiddush Hashem, but as a Gentile. And so how do you...
Could they be buried with the Arabs?
Why would they bury... No, they're Muslim. They're not... That's Muslim.
I know. Well, I didn't know how exclusive...
And who wants
the
to be
Muslims
buried with the Arabs?
Well, no, you don't. But some Gentiles wouldn't give a rip.
Not Gentiles in Israel.
Oh, okay.
Gentiles in Israel
give a rip. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. It's very polarized there.
Okay.
They do.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, they see everything firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very different. Anyway, so the Ramban holds that it's two separate mitzvahs. The separating of the dough, separating of the portion from the dough is one mitzvah. And the giving it to the Kohen is a separate mitzvah. So that's not how he holds. But that's how he holds. So it's just interesting
to
know
that.
You can certainly see his reasoning.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right, why he would do it. Yeah. And so just to review, also last week we said that this mitzvah only applies to doughs that include the five grains that can make chametz. So that's wheat, rye, oats, barley, and spelt. If you make challah, or any dough out of rice flour, corn flour, teff flour, whatever else they make it out of, quinoa flour,
sorghum,
right.
Right.
Yeah, I once gave Celia Fetter a bouquet of flowers, but it was all different baking flowers.
Oh,
I made a basket and gave her
that's so cute.
Baking flowers, because she's into different non-gluten things.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of flours you can use today. So only the flours made out of wheat, rye, oats, barley, and spelt will require that challah be taken. And they will mix together. So if you have like a cup of each, well, you need more than that because we said last time you need 16 cups of flour in order for the mitzvah to kick in. So if you have 4 cups of wheat and 4 cups of rye and 4 cups of oats and 4 cups of barley, that counts. That's 16 cups of flour that adds together and the mitzvah kicks in. But if you have 4 cups of wheat and 4 cups of barley and 4 cups of rice and 4 cups of corn, then you only have 8 cups of flour that require it in your 16 cup dough, and then the mitzvah of challah does not apply.
Mm-hmm. Is buckwheat wheat?
No.
I didn't think it was, but
I
ask.
It's not, yeah.
Okay.
It's not.
So that's interesting. It's almost as if someone knew down the road that gluten-free would become an issue.
It is interesting to hear how different things are set up for all that stuff, for sure.
If a Kohen was gluten-free, we'd...
If a Kohen was gluten-free, then he would just have he would have to eat off of the trumas, not off of the challah.
Yeah.
Because we do offer up from our sorghum, from our corn from our rice, we're still separating our tithes and giving that to them.
Right.
And then they would have to go and grind it into flour and make it into whatever they're going to make it.
Okay.
So, but they wouldn't get their hunk of dough from us. They just would have to give that to the gluten full.
Right.
Kohen. Let's see. We keep it outside of the land of Israel to keep our love of the land of Israel alive and to be a placeholder for that mitzvah so that we won't forget it. And also so that to keep our yearning for the geula alive so that we won't think to ourselves, I don't know if I want the Mashiach to come and Geula to come, because if it does, then I don't get to keep all my food. You know, so we don't want to like start grumbling when we go into the land, like, oh, I used to be able to eat everything, and now I have to give 10% to the Kohen. You know, so we don't want to become people like that. So we keep it, we keep giving it and giving it, still in Chutz La'aretz, still in Galus, Chutz La'aretz outside of the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Still in exile, so that we will maintain the place and maintain the desire and maintain the hope for the whole system to be reestablished. So I try to feel sad when I throw it away. I don't burn it. I don't like the smell of burned bread in my house. I double wrap it and throw it away. But I try to feel sad when I throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
And and as I gently place it double wrapped in the garbage,
mm-hmm.
I think I would really rather give this to a Kohen.
For sure.
Wouldn't it be nice if I could be handing this to a Kohen?
Yes.
And the Kohen will come into your house. You don't take it to them, they come to you.
Oh.
And what's nice about them coming to you is then you have a Torah teacher in your home so that you can ask whatever home-based shilas you have. You have a little privacy and you can show them whatever, you know, little thing. I think I gave the example before. I had a rice cooker. I wasn't sure if I'm allowed to take rice out of it on Shabbos or not. I had asked a shila once, but that rabbi didn't know what it looked like, you know, so he said based on what he's thinking. But then finally one day the rav came in, our new rav, his blech blew out, something happened, the blech was turned off on Shabbos Friday night, but his cholent was still hot, his wife had put it up, and I guess the next day they needed the hot cholent for lunch, so he came blech hunting, right, so you can, because you can do that, so he came to our house. He lived pretty close, and he asked if he could see our blach first. He had to know if it was halachic, and then could he put it on our blach? Yes, no problem. But since he was right there, I said, see this rice cooker? Can I take rice out of it on Shabbos? So it's nice to have the teacher in your house to be able to answer your question about your specific situation.
And so what was the answer?
Yes. I can't.
Okay. Okay.
I can't, because the other one had said, I can only... So the rice has the top closes on a hinge, and it has a pot that comes out. So the other rabbi said, I have to take the pot out, then I can close it, and then I can't put it back in. So that means I can have it for Friday night, but not for Shabbos day, right? But he said that you can take it, you can open it up and just take scoop it right out, which you usually can't do. I forgot all the reasonings of it, but he said you can do that because if you would take it out, you can't put it back in. And if you're going to want it for the next day and you can't put it back in, then you can take it out straight from there.
Oh,
I was like,
okay.
Well, that's nice. That now I can have hot rice on Shabbos day too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just nice that he knew all the right rules to be able to rule on that.
Yeah, we're really blessed to have him. We
yeah.
truly are.
So anyway, it's nice to have the Kohen come into your house to be able to see what's going on. Okay, and just finally, if one forgets to take two things. If one mixes the challah back into the dough, they separated it, set aside, I immediately put it in a plastic bag. I take out the plastic bag first, a sandwich bag, and then I make the bracha, pull it out of the dough, and put it in the Ziploc bag, seal it shut. Right? And then I might set that aside before I say my whole thing. I say my tefillah on the whatever I want to do, but I know it's set aside. But let's say you don't, right? Let's say you separate it, and you set it aside, and now you're starting to braid, and your kids or your grandkids come in and they want a piece of dough and they take a piece of dough and they take that other little piece of dough and they put it together and like all of a sudden you're like, where's the challah? And you don't know, it's mixed back into the dough. Now the whole dough can't be eaten. The whole dough is kadosh.
Mm.
So what do you do? That's a big problem, which is why I take out my Ziploc bag first. It's a very big problem because basically what you have to do for that, it can be fixed, but it's a big deal. Pain in the neck on an Erev Shabbos you have to go before three rabbis and renounce your challah. You have to say, I took it, and but I had in mind that it was for that piece was for challah, and I never would have separated that piece of challah if I would have known that piece would have gone back into the dough. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the entire challah is null and void, and I have to retake it. But you have to actually go through that ceremony to make it work. So it's something you definitely don't want to run up against. Take out your Ziploc bag first and put it in there right away so you don't run up against that. But let's say you just forgot altogether. Now it's baked and you're thinking, did I take challah or not take challah? I think I did it. If you're sure you didn't, you can still take it with a bracha. If you're not sure you didn't, you still have to take it without a bracha after it's baked. So you put all the baked ones together, you put something over in a towel or something like that to make it all back into one, since they're all clearly separate pieces now. But they're all separate pieces, that none of which can be eaten. So you have to cover the whole thing and then make your bracha and then separate it from one of the things. You don't have to take something from each one of them. The covering the whole thing makes it all back into one dough. So you just separate from one roll or one loaf, a hunk, and set that aside.
Almost like an Arab.
covering
all the pieces.
Right. So that's the story with the challah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we should go into. Any other questions on this before we move to our next mitzvah?
And in this case, challah, whether it's got raisins in it or...
Okay. Thank you. So it has nothing to do with challah.
Okay, all right.
At all whatsoever. Okay. It has to do with a dough. The reason that we call our Sabbath bread challah is because of this challah portion that we separate from it.
Okay.
So the portion that we separate from it is what's technically known as challah. Oh. What's colloquially known as challah is the braided Sabbath bread, whether it's got poppy seeds, raisins, sugar, water, whatever it is, that's challah. But it has nothing, one to do with the other, not really. The reason why the name transferred is because, in general, this mitzvah was done in preparation for the Sabbath, when you'd be making a Sabbath bread. So it has to do with preparing for Shabbos. We are permitted to purchase challah for Shabbos if we find that's better than the challah that we make, or the challah that, even if we're good at making challah, but we don't have the time, so you still, L'Kavod Shabbos could buy. But it does seem that L'Kavod Shabbos, in the honor of Shabbos, it's better to make it if you can. Mm-hmm. So the name transferred, but it's not. That's just in a way, what we call challah is just a nickname. Okay. That's just how we call it. The challah technically refers to that piece that separates. So if you make whole wheat, sprouted grain, artisan bread on Tuesday with 16 cups of flour, you have to take challah from it. Doesn't matter when you make it, doesn't matter if it's for Shabbos or not. Any bread that you make, any dough that you make, with 16 cups plus, requires challah to be separated from that dough.
Okay, that's
has nothing to do with Shabbos bread, except for Shabbos bread's part of the entire category of doughs that require it. So if you make babka, which is a yeasted dough, right, you make babka a real dough. It's questions if it applies to other things, but even people say that, I think without a bracha, right? Without a bracha, you take from cupcakes. Without a bracha. If you make cupcakes for 150 people and you're using, 4 pounds plus of flour, 16 cups plus of flour, to make your cupcakes, you separate after the cupcakes are baked because you don't just take a spoonful of batter. Mm-hmm. So really the mitzvah is on dough. Okay. But babka's dough, right? So if you, or even I think, even if you would make a flaky dough, it doesn't have yeast in it, but you make that much dough, once you've kneaded it, then you separate from the dough. But anything that has 16 and plus cups, you separate from.
Okay. So does it mean that when you buy something that is kosher, like from a bakery, it means that they've already done it?
Yeah, they've done it.
Don't they usually say
challah? They often say it on the packaging.
You
challah
probably
has been
should
taken.
Ask.
Okay.
Yeah. If it doesn't say
a bakery, a uh-huh. bakery with a heksher, you don't have to ask.
No. Okay.
Right. You do not. You
so
can,
even if
absolutely.
It's just right. like a right. Orthodox union, just regular.
Do not worry about that at all whatsoever.
That's
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah. No. Okay. Once it's okay. got a heksher on it, it's been okay. taken. That's part of making it edible.
And it's only for dough, right? So like milk products, you don't have to.
Right, no. Only for dough. Only the five grains mm-hmm. plus water mixed together. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's when that's required.
Okay.
But anything else is not. So if you have corn chips, no problem. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about it at all.
Can I go back to the rice cooker question?
Yeah.
In general, mm-hmm. just can you explain again, please, what is it that you can't do, take out, and then on Shabbos, I just completely...
That's a whole question of blechs, how blechs work and how putting things on fire and off fire or on electric fire and off electric fire works on Shabbos.
So how do, if you're serving, you can serve individual plates from your...
So if you have a...
pot that is plugged in.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, so it's actually, you can take it out and put it in a bowl, too, to put it on the table.
Uh-huh.
But, and this is electric, so it's different than over a flame. Okay. There's all kinds of different halachas, so I don't want to necessarily say specifically. From the rice cooker specifically, you can take and so also, if you would have a crock pot, that the crock doesn't come out.
Right.
Then you can scoop from that. That's from what he said. From that, and put it into a bowl.
You can do that.
You can't put anything back in.
Okay.
But you could.
So if there is a leftover, you cannot return it back.
Right. Okay. But if you have a crock pot, apparently where the crock can come out, you should take it out to serve it. Because it's a whole big thing. You're not supposed to serve things from right on top of the flame. So when I have soup on my blech, and the flame, let's say I have my blech is this size, right? And the flame is right here, and my pot is right here, my pot of soup. So I move it to here to serve from. I don't take it off my blech. I just slide it off the flame. Because you're not supposed to dip that ladle in over the flame. That will cause stirring. So I'm not supposed to stir it over the flame.
Over the flame.
So I move it to the side.
All it has to do with cooling and reheating.
So how do you take the rice out?
And the Shabbos rules of cooking and reheating water.
Because it's in my swim and take it out. Yeah. I know. But he said. He was there. He looked at it. That's what he said.
Take it out.
He's the rabbi.
From the rice cooker.
He said, because the rice cooker, I do not have to take the pot out. He said, I can take it right out.
Well, you're not stirring anything. It's not too.
From a crock pot. From a crock pot, I think, is different than over the flame. Even though it's
similar.
Well,
it's sort of
similar.
I
think that's a difference.
I'm trying to judge.
Right, I think it's different. So you could scoop it right out of a crock pot. If it's the kind of crock pot that doesn't separate. If it's the kind that does separate, you have to lift it out to take it out. And then you can put it back. But that's different than having the lid close over the whole top. The crock pot has the thing that sets in with the lid that sits inside of it. Whereas my rice cooker has a full lid that folds over the entire thing. Whatever, it's a different...
Some people put a little fish can, you know, like a star, down so that it's not directly... touching even the electrical unit within the crock pot.
They make a black.
They make like
out.
A black in the crock pot.
Yeah,
right.
That's what they say to do.
Right.
I think that has something to do if you remove it.
Right, and then you can put it back.
Then you can put it back if you have it made like a black.
Then you can put it back.
Okay, let's move on to, did that help at all with your question?
Okay.
It's tricky. When you want to learn how to set up blechs, you really have to have a whole blech lesson.
Right.
It's a whole big, tricky thing.
I don't do it because it's too complicated.
It is really
I learned all of the laws originally. But
you have to learn and relearn them because they seem to escape you.
Yeah.
It's amazing when we have Hilchos Shabbos classes on the West Side with everybody who's been keeping Shabbos for decades.
Yeah.
Everybody's taking notes and everybody's asking questions because everybody's saying, really?
Yeah.
It's shocking
how
many people.
Because they came from different homes that had different understandings.
Not just that, you just slide into your patterns
and you
sometimes forget.
Yeah.
You know, you start to do things slightly wrong and then it becomes wrong and then you learn the halacha and you're like, oh. Or you start to not do something because you think it's too complicated and then you think to yourself that it's not permitted.
Yeah.
And then you learn that it is and you're also surprised.
I have a hot plate that I a warmer tray that has no controls, doesn't only goes to a certain temperature, and if I do lunch at home, I have that.
Okay. 386. The mitzvah of tzitzis. Okay, so this is a long mitzvah. Let's see, how long is this mitzvah? And it really is, in a way, a two-part mitzvah, but we're not going to do the second part today. We'll do the second part tomorrow, next week, which is 387, not to go straying after one's heart and eyes, which is a mitzvah, a positive mitzvah. And actually that one, 387, is one of the mitzvot to midiot. There are six constant mitzvahs, and that's one of them. But leading into it is this mitzvah 386 of putting tzitzit on the garments. So what is this mitzvah? The obligation applies when the garment has four corners or more. So as it is written, on the four corners of your cloak, and this includes clothing with five or more than four, whose measure is large enough so that a child who can walk about in the marketplace without a guardian can cover his head and most of his body with it. That's an interesting measurement, right?
Yeah.
So, child. So, just to listen to a few different things. So, here's a cultural slice of time for you, right? A child who can walk around without a guardian. How old is that child? Don't look at the text. If you looked already, don't say.
I'm going to say five.
Three. After three. Child.
A child who can walk around in the marketplace without a guardian. Yeah. How old is that child?
Today.
21.
right. Today. Back
without
then.
A guardian.
I would say five or six.
Right. So that's what it says. Five or six.
Oh, is it?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Six or seven. Six or seven. That's old enough to send your child alone to go shopping for you. Right? That you can send them from the house and they can walk around the marketplace without a guardian. Right? A child of that age, six or seven, a garment has to be big enough to cover that child. Mm. That's how big it is. From that size of garment and above, that's the size that's required in tzitzis. So what does that mean? So back in the day, you know, when people wore togas
or
saris
or
wrapped things, they didn't have garments that were cut with sleeves and set-in sleeves and waistlines and all that stuff. You know, they're wearing like a cloak or just a big piece of cloth, the circle in the middle, and you put it over and then you kind of wrap it around in a belt. And that's your outfit, you know, or a few of those, that kind of thing. So you've got a lot of four-cornered things that you're wearing.
Boy, we could save money. Think about it.
Not in this climate.
Well, one of them is wool. You have to have a wool one, yes.
So it has to be a four-corner garment. So it used to be that people wore four-corner garments a lot, right? So it's the four-corner garment or more corners that's required in tzitzis. A two-cornered garment, let's say any one of our shirts today. Think about a button-down shirt, right? It has corners at the bottom, right at the bottom of the buttons. There's two corners, but there's no other corners in the shirt. So that's a two-cornered garment is not required tzitzis. So there's this concept of four-cornered garments at 4M plus that requires tzitzis, and less than 4 does not require tzitzis. So what's the point of this mitzvah? The point of this mitzvah is?
I've always thought it was to remind. So in other words, when you have those each separate little thread that if it was constantly on you, it was a reminder.
I guess of
the mitzvahs and to pray of Hashem, I guess.
Right. So that's what it is. It is meant to be a reminder of the mitzvahs. Now, some people say it's meant to. There is a list of seven mitzvahs. I did not see this article. I just heard about it, where Volbe writes about the seven mitzvahs that are equal in weight to all the mitzvahs. So those seven mitzvahs are circumcision, tzedakah, living in the land of Israel, Shabbos, tzitzis, Torah, and avodah zarah. And I'm imagining, again, since I didn't read the article and just gave the list with avodah zarah in it, that that's the negative, not the positive. But those seven mitzvahs are equal in weight to all the mitzvahs.
Would you repeat those just once more?
Circumcision. Mila. So that's called Mila.
Right.
Mila, tzedakah, Eretz Yisrael, Shabbat, tzitzit, avodah zarah, Torah, learning Torah. So those are keneged kulam, right? When we say Talmud Torah keneged kulam, when we say Birkas HaTorah in the morning, the learning Torah is opposite to all of them. So that's one of them. these are mitzvahs that are all keneged kulam, right? Are opposite all the mitzvahs. So tzitzit, how are tzitzit? So they have a mathematical illusion. The word tzitzit, tzadik yud taf, equals 600. With 8 strings and 5 knots, that adds up to 613. Right, so that's just a mathematical illusion. It's not a proof, but it just is that it's supposed to equal all of them. How does it equal all of them? Because we see them. We see them, and it is supposed to, it's white, they're supposed to be white, with a petil techelet, with a thread of techelet. Question is, what color is techelet? It happens to be a machloket, of course, as most things are in Judaism. It happens to be an argument. What color is techelet? So I'll ask you, what color do you think techelet is?
A form of blue.
A form of blue, but it's a question if possibly it's a black.
Mm, really?
Now, when I say a black, that's probably a blue black. Oops. Maybe not turned off.
That's a nice tune.
It is.
You know, I just read something. I don't know. I keep getting this periodically on email, but scientists in Israel have discovered the marine animal that exudes this color when you smash it or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was lost for thousands of years and it was found again.
Right. There are movements
it's
in Israel that they use that
it's like
today.
They think it's marine. Like a snail or
yeah.
some
a sort
of
snail-like.
What shellfish?
Right.
Yeah.
Busy learning about Sharon. I didn't catch the sea animal.
Sea animal.
Marine, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a type of sea animal that has the color. So it does seem like they have found techelet again. Where is the pasuk? I wish I would have the exact pasuk. Let's see if I can remember it.
That's odd that it would show up now.
I know.
It's been some time ago.
Okay,
Vasulahem tzitzit
akantei vigdei hem ladur tam hakanaf petil techelet, right? So it says, make tzitzit for your generations on the corners of your garment and include a petil techelet. So listen to the order. Make tzitzit throughout your generations on the corners of your garment and include a thread of blue. So some people say the make tzitzit is for your generations, but not the thread of blue. Because right, here's what it says. Make tzitzit for your generations,
right.
and include a thread of blue.
To me,
so
it's
it
all
could
one
say,
statement. Yeah.
Maybe it is,
yeah.
but it could say, make tzitzit with a thread of blue for your generations, but it doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
It says, make tzitzit for your generations.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be an allusion to the fact that we will have tzitzit for generations that don't include a thread of blue, which is what we've had, actually, for the last 2,000 years, no thread of blue, and the thread of blue is being rediscovered. So we do usually translate techelet as blue, but it is a machloket if it's blue or a type of black. So it could be like that very midnighty black, which actually is
a form of blue.
Mm-hmm. Very, very dark blue. So the illusion that we have on our taluses, so the talus is that four-cornered garment, right? The illusion that we have on our taluses to that petil techelet, that thread of blue, that techelet, let's just say techelet,
mm-hmm.
is the stripes on the talus. So think about taluses that you have seen.
I didn't know that.
Color are their stripes?
Mm-hmm.
Either
black or blue. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Cover your bases.
Right. It's either blue or black. That
yeah.
doesn't cover the halachic base. It's just a memorial base. So it's, and that shows the machloket. It's either blue or black.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be either. You don't need stripes in a talus. It's just an illusion. Right, it's just, and so the Israeli flag has those two stripes. It is an allusion to the talus, to have the white with the stripes, and that the techelet is in modern Hebrew. Techelet refers to the color of the blue of the star and the stripes on the flag, on the Israeli flag. That's what we call techelet. So, and we call blue eyes techelet. Also, even all the colors of blue, but techelet refers to that color blue that's in the Israeli flag. But that color blue that's in the Israeli flag is from the imagination of people who are thinking about the techelet and the tzitzis.
That's so interesting that they would incorporate that
You know? They were not.
I mean,
they
non-religious.
Were
talking about non-religious people.
Very
you know,
Jewish people.
Right, right.
It's so important to like we view people through our own lenses, and we can't. You know, so the same thing.
I don't think that's so. I mean, they were non-religious people who were setting up the original state, wanted to divorce everything from any religiosity, and yet the blue is there.
You're wrong. They were not wanting to divorce everything. You're viewing it through what you think.
What I read.
Yeah, but first of all, you've read things written by people that are anti-Zionists today. But you have to remember things that, you have to remember breadth of things. So for instance, I'll just give you for instance of where we mix things up very frequently. So today, we Jews today really judge harshly the generation of American Jews who lived during the Holocaust. Why didn't they march in Washington? Why didn't they push their congressmen harder? Why didn't they break down the walls and open up the gates of America to save their brethren in Europe? Nobody did that then. Nobody was marching.
Too right. Busy assimilating. I understand that.
That they were too busy assimilating.
Right.
Nobody went to Washington. They were
wasn't
fearful.
Something
we
that
have
was
to
done.
Understand, before the state of Israel, the Jew
different.
Was a scared creature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We did not walk around waving our yarmulkes saying, we demand rights. That's not who we were at all. Mm-hmm. We're a totally different being. Since the state of Israel.
Right.
Totally
right.
different.
Right.
This is pre-state of Israel, having come after years of oppression, centuries, millennia of oppression in Europe. Right? We were still scared all the way around, sneaking in. I mean, even though it was, obviously we were open, but we felt sneaking into universities, sneaking into country clubs, sneaking into business, mm-hmm. we were quiet about it. Mm-hmm. We did not want to be broadcasting our Judaism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very quiet about it. You know, and nobody was marching in Washington. It didn't happen yet. Mm-hmm. So certainly the Jews weren't. There just was nobody like that. So if we take our lenses and look at that generation, we will completely misunderstand them.
So you're telling me that was not Herzog and all of their goal was to establish a secular state.
It was to establish a secular Jewish
state. Right.
Jewish.
Right. But I'm just connecting such a religious thing is what I'm saying.
No, absolutely not. No, it was very Jewish.
Right.
It was a very Jewish state. We have to remember, and it's hard to, but the word, today when we say the word Yiddishkeit, we mean Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
But in Yiddish, the word Yiddishkeit does not mean Judaism. It means Jewishness.
Yeah.
It means Jackie Mason's humor. That's what Yiddishkeit means. It means bagels and borscht and the borscht belt in the Catskills. That's Yiddishkeit. It means socialism and communism and Bundists and the Arbiter Ring and Yiddish theater. That's Yiddishkeit. So today, we've just switched. Like when we say awesome, that's awesome. If we think that word only means what we mean today, you know, that's like when my kids came home from yeshiva with brand new Shabbos shoes and said to me, look at my pimpin' shoes. I was like, I went to wash his mouth out with soap for saying that. Right. He's like, Ima, it doesn't mean that. I'm like, yes, it does. It comes from a terrible word. You can't say that. But words change.
Right.
And
for sure,
historic context changes. And today, to pimp your ride just means, I still don't want to say it even, but it just means to make your car look cool. It does not mean anything about prostitution.
You think I'd ever hear those words come out of your mouth.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I shouldn't be saying it, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's in a different context.
Yeah.
So Yiddishkeit too, and secular too. Secular means something different. Secular in this country means different than secular in Israel, and secular in 2014 means different than secular in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Very different.
Mm-hmm. That begs a question that I've been contemplating as the passing of Sharon happened.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like the new generation in Israel is how they're going to lead versus the way that this generation led?
Very different. For sure.
Yeah,
I mean, Sharon's a great example. Sharon, Alava Shalom.
Yes.
And he made his mistakes, and he probably saved the state of Israel.
Right.
you know, in 1957. I didn't even realize what he did, but it was such a brilliant move.
Oh.
You know, and American, you know, West Point studying him and his ability right. to think that way right, because he was so brilliant in understanding the topography and using the topography and the element of surprise. He was like Washington. Like, he totally knew what he was doing, you know, in a brilliant way. And he saved the state of Israel, which could have been completely obliterated in 1973 if he had not understood how to go behind the Barlev lines and save it. And he made some mistakes. Sovereign Shatila, was that his fault? It wasn't his fault, but did he let down his guard? Possibly.
He's human.
Yeah, he's a human being. So,
the clearing out.
But
of the
he's a very good example yeah. of that breed of Jew who was not observant and so Jewish. So Jewish. So the Tchelet, of course. I mean, what else would you use as a color? So obvious. It's completely different than today. Completely different. So, and that's what Ben-Gurion said. He wanted a nation of apikorsim, which means you know enough Torah to reject it. And what he got instead, frustratingly, was a generation of amoratsim, of people who were just ignorant. You know, so today's Jews
and I think he admitted that too. Didn't
yeah,
he
said
he?
That.
Yeah, he did.
But
he that was a problem.
Know from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They know from it. They're very Jewish. It's very different than today, where you have ignorance.
It seems it's religious, and that's what.
I'm
that's
saying
what surprises
it's so
me.
Different. It's no, but it's Jewish. They wanted a Jewish state.
Yeah, I know.
Not, but their definition of Jewish was that old definition of Yiddishkeit.
Right.
They wanted Jewish. Not Torah. They don't want Torah state.
But this is Torah. That's what I'm saying.
So what I'm saying is you cannot draw lines between Torah
I'm
and
just
Jewish.
Saying it's interesting to me that they would draw back on that.
It's like a Star of David on the flag. Mm-hmm. They could have thought of like a five-pointed star because,
right.
know, you could say that they wanted to create
but it was
a kind
Jewish.
Of socialist
yeah.
state with
yeah.
kibbutz
yeah.
and
right.
you know, all that.
It's just interesting to me that it's...
They did.
Right, so that's what
it's
I'm saying.
Yeah.
You do have to expand your understanding of what secular was to them. They did not want it to be a Torah-based state, and yet it still was going to be Jewish. It's still the banks would be closed on Yom Kippur. How else are you going to have your picnic? But they're still closing an Yom Kippur,
right.
you know, like,
huh.
so,
yeah.
absolutely,
yeah.
Jewish, they're,
okay.
yeah, very Jewish.
Regardless of where the tradition, Jewish tradition, or inside came from, that didn't matter.
The point was a Jewish state for Jews.
Well, plus they were, you know, even before the state was created, officially, there were very religious Jews who lived
oh, for
there
sure. for
in
sure.
the land. And,
yeah,
you know.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, and
no
and
doubt
and
about
had,
that.
These were the people who lived there, actually. They were probably all religious Jews who lived in
yes.
Palestine
mm-hmm.
before
mm-hmm.
1940.
In order
yeah.
to tough that out, for sure.
1880.
Yeah. Before 1880.
Then, well, mm-hmm. but even during the British mandate, they still lived there, right?
Yeah, yes. but I'm yes. saying before 1880, I think they were exclusively religious.
Yeah.
And from 1880, yeah. from those first aliyahs coming in, those mm-hmm. waves of aliyah, that's when some secular Jews started coming in.
Yeah.
It was from 1880. But before 1880,
right.
I think it was, you probably yeah. couldn't have found a secular
right.
Jew that wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But from then, that's when they started to come. And then there was that conflict between what kind of a state will we be established? Should there be a state at all? And if there is, how should it be established? But whether it should be Jewish or not wasn't a
no
question.
No question. No, I understand.
And Jewish
that.
Can
talking
only
religious
be defined in the terms of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Only.
That's really true.
So
you can't really separate.
Right. So, but they. I mean, so they tried, but yeah. you can't. But in their minds, they're trying to do that. So,
right.
you know, for whatever, however they did that, but you can only. It's only Jewish in terms of the Torah. So it was definitely.
Right.
So even somebody who has their annual ball on Yom Kippur, it's 100% Jewish because they know that's a special day to Shtach Hashem.
Mm.
You know, if they didn't believe in God and if they didn't believe the day was special, why make your ball then?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But truly,
so,
the largest group of the population that's growing the quickest is the Orthodox population in Israel.
Yes.
So it's,
yeah.
you know, I mean, it's...
Right.
It's obviously taking a turn.
It's still a minority.
I think it is still a minority, but so the actual Shomer
barely,
Shabbos,
yes.
Shomer Mitzvahs crowd is a minority. However,
there's 6 million Jews there.
Yeah, it did. again, based on a book that I just read, and then I checked some figures on the internet. No, it's like 46%
really?
Is what they.
I don't think 46% is orthodox. I'm pretty sure not 46, but I'm sure at least 46, probably a higher percent is traditional.
Well, maybe that's okay. Well, maybe I'm confusing the terms.
Yeah, of those people who feel that there is a God, He gave the Torah. They're Jewish because He gave the Torah, and there's stuff we should do about it. I think that's the majority of the the Jewish population of Israel.
Yeah.
Only a subset of that actually keeps Shabbos and carefully kosher. But your average Jew on the street in Israel believes in God, believes He gave the Torah, and believes that there's mitzvahs because of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they believe the whole package or do the whole package or know about the whole package even is a different question. But that, your average Jew on the street believes that. And that is called traditional. If somebody believes that, they're called a traditional Jew. The conservative Jews were brilliant in adopting the name traditional for themselves, Masorti. Masorti is traditional.
Mm.
So the conservative movement, when they wanted to make inroads into Israel, all those Jews who called themselves Masorti, I make Kiddush Friday night, I light candles before I watch a movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't eat meat and milk together, right? That's how my home is. I have one set of dishes, but meat and milk will never be on those dishes at the same time. That Jew is Masorti.
Okay.
So, and that Jew is your average cab driver who wears a yarmulke or doesn't, who calls his wife Nishama when she calls him, you know. So, yeah.
Soul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that's his, instead of saying honey, he calls her Nishama, right? So, that's your Jew on the street in Israel. And they are called Masorti. And so the conservative movement, when they wanted to make inroads in Israel, adopted the name Masorti, thinking they get to adopt everybody who calls themselves that. So it was a brilliant move on the part of conservative Jews in that nomenclature. But anyway, so but those Jews would be called by many from Jews secular.
Right. I can see that.
And they're not.
And they're not. No.
They are not.
They shouldn't be, as long as they're not. If they... You know, acknowledge that there was a creator and that he gave a Torah.
So the right-wing Jews
land,
would call those Jews
that's
secular.
A different deal.
Those Jews would not call themselves secular.
Right.
Chiloni, and though they would call themselves Masorti, Chiloni is somebody who is much more secular than America's secular Jews. America's secular Jews, and now let's just move the clock 20 years ago, because today it's a different situation. But 20 years ago, Israel's secular Jews were proactively secular. Or against Torah. And America's secular Jews, then as now, are passively secular. They just don't know that much. And they don't care.
Okay.
And they don't keep it. But they're not saying the Torah... And they might say the Torah's wrong, but they're not saying, you're stupid for keeping it. Now, we're starting to breed some of those in the last few years with this new militant atheism. That's a whole different thing. But secular here is a passive thing. Secular there is an active thing. So you cannot say the state of Israel. You have to just broaden some understandings. It's not, they were not trying to create an actively secular. They were trying to quash religious compulsion.
Well, that's what that was my,
but not Jewish,
my thought back
flavor,
in the 40s.
But not Jewish flavor.
Flavor, okay.
Not Jewish flavor.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, tzitzit. Oh, we're at the end, but let me just quickly say tzitzit. D'oraisa have to be made out of wool or linen. The garment has to be a wool or linen garment to require it. And it seems today that cotton counts as a garment. So it's natural fibers that can be woven together. Fibers that can't be woven together, like leather, do not require tzitzit. So if you have a leather four-corner garment, no tzitzit on that. And that begs the question today of nylon synthetics. Do they count? If you make a mesh, you've seen those lightweight mesh tzitzis that like the basketball players wear or whatever, they're very lightweight. That's really a shayla, if that requires tzitzis at all. And some people say they do not. And so those people who are careful would say that that doesn't count. And they also might be too small, right? You have a minimum size for the garment that requires tzitzit. Mm-hmm. So some people would say the tallit for morning prayers is their donning of tzitzis for the day. They put on a large enough tallit. It has to be at least 24 inches wide. as a minimum. So a lot of those conservative shawls that are like 12 inches wide, they don't count at all. They're nothing. And they're polyester, so they're nothing. But wool, and at least 24 inches wide as a minimum, you put that on in the morning, and that covers your mitzvah of tzitzit. But in general, we hold that it should be worn all day. And so people wear a talit katan. They make a special garment to be able to wear it. You're not required to wear it if you're not wearing a four-corner garment. There's no requirement. Nevertheless, it seems like, just like Maariv, the evening prayer, is optional, but today it's become required because it's just become the broader acceptance among the Jewish community that we all daven Maariv, we, meaning men, all daven Maariv, so that's a required prayer now. And we, all men, wear tzitzis, a four-corner garment, so they make the four-corner garment for the purposes of wearing tzitzis. Women are not required. And we have this whole category of mitzvahs called positive time-bound commandments. Mitzvot asay, positive. Shehazman, that time, grama, causes. Right? So included in that category would be sitting in the sukkah, shaking the lulav, hearing the shofar, saying the shema. Those are all positive time-bound commandments. Tefillin, tzitzis, are positive time-bound commandments. They have a specific time that they're related to. They're positive, not negative. And a negative time-bound commandment, for instance, would include not eating chametz. That's a negative time-bound commandment. That's not year-round. It has a specific time. We are required to do any negative. All women are required in all negative time-bound commandments that men are required to do. But if time-bound, positive time-bound, we're not required to do all of. There are a few that we are required now, just like Maariv. So shofar is one of them. We're not required in the other ones. Well, shema, we're still not required, but we get the mitzvah if we do it. Sukkah, we're not required, but we get the mitzvah if we do it. Lulav shaking, again, not required. We get some level of mitzvah if we do it. Ashkenazi women get enough of a mitzvah by doing it that they're permitted to say the blessing on it. Sephardi women do not say the blessing on shaking a lulav. Unlike those mitzvot, where women are permitted and even get schar for doing them, talis, tefillin, and tzitzis, women are discouraged from, or some would even say not permitted, to do those mitzvot. So one reason why is over the course of time, it seems that those two, since they're both things that you wear, those two garments, even though tefillin aren't garments, are men's garments, and women aren't permitted to put on a man's garment. It's possible that there could be some halachic space somewhere for some individual, but certainly as a community, women do not. There is no group of women who are God-fearing, mitzvah-keeping women who wear tzitzis. No, just no such thing. That's not what women do. So it's not our commandment. We can wear a four-corner garment, no problem. Put on a scarf, a pashmina, whatever it is. You know, no tzitzis necessary for us. I wonder, and I don't know, what if a man in Mexico, he wears a pashmina. He's like, you know, a more Mexican. Mm-hmm. And he wears something like that's big enough like that. Is that required in tzitzis? I think it
like
probably is.
Like those serapis were.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I think it is required. I don't think they can just throw that on. Mm-hmm. I think it is required in tzitzis.
Because it is wool.
Yeah.
Most cases they've done made them.
So I think that would be. But for a woman, it's not. Mm. So we're permitted to wear it. Anything else? Oh, yeah. So just one more thing I want to say about it. Sorry to keep you late on this one mitzvah, but the strings. So in looking at the strings hanging down, one of the things that we should be thinking about, so when we see those strings, we think about the 613 mitzvahs, right? So there's a question, should they show, should they not show? You do not have to keep them tucked out if you don't want to, although a lot of yeshivisha guys today do wear them tucked out. Their garment is hidden, but their tzitzis are outside of their pants, so you see them hanging on the side just to remind you, but you don't have to do that. But if you do see the strings, what should it remind you of? It should remind you that every mitzvah is a string. Every mitzvah is a string to grasp onto a heavenly concept. That when you see it, it's a something that connects up and down. And that each one is a connecting force. Mm-hmm. Every mitzvah is a string that can tie you to the Kisei HaKavod, that can tie you to Hashem's glory. And we should know to grasp onto it and be drawn up. So that little bit of tchelet that we will see in it is supposed to remind you of And it's a long, it's interesting, it's a long process. So this reminds you of the sea, which reminds you of the sky, which reminds you of Hashem. Mm-hmm. Those three things, goes in that order. Okay. So so what is that, right? Now, Harvey Rosner said, which I think is interesting, he said, you know, a man's not supposed to look at a woman's colored garments. Forget women, right? He sees a clothesline with women's clothing drying in the breeze. He's not supposed to gaze at it. Because if he looks at their colored garments, he could start to think inappropriate thoughts. So we do understand that seeing things triggers thoughts, right? Just as a concept. Seeing things triggers thoughts. Seeing tzitzis is supposed to trigger holy thoughts. You see the color. So does color trigger good thoughts or bad thoughts, right? Colored garments could trigger bad thoughts. Colored tzitzis could trigger good thoughts. What's up with that? So what does color trigger in your thinking? So he said it really has to do with what you're thinking about the rest of the time when you see a color. So for that, he brings the Passover song, Who Knows One, right? So which we sing at the end of the Seder, right? So at the end of the Seder, we sing this song. And what is that song supposed to say? We've now immersed our thoughts in Torah so much and in discussing so much that no matter what we think of, we should immediately be thinking of Torah. Who knows one? That's Hashem. Who knows two? That's the tablets. Who knows three? That's the fathers. Who knows four? That's the mothers. Who knows five? That's the... As soon as you hear that number, right away you're thinking Torah. You know, five is the books of the Torah. Eight is circumcision, right? Like immediately, you're just thinking Torah. Whatever comes up, you're just thinking Torah. It's like a Rorschach test. You know, like see the picture, think Torah. See the number, think Torah. See the color, think Torah. So it should be that our thoughts are immersed enough in Torah that when we see that color, we think Hashem right away. Like what else is there to think, right? So we don't need to be thinking negative thoughts. It should be positive thoughts. But it has to do with what our other thoughts are, where our thoughts go.
But obviously women were just elevated to a status where we don't have those thoughts.
Well, we have less of those thoughts, I think.
Right.
But we do still have to focus our thoughts. You know, we absolutely have to be careful mm-hmm. of what we see and what we hear and what we think, mm-hmm. what we read, what we put into ourselves.
Right.
Because we do have that kind of stuff. We're not, I don't think we are as susceptible as men to going right. straight to a negative place, that we need as much protection, which is why we don't have to, one reason why we don't have to wear tzitzis. But we still see the tzitzis and we could still learn from it. And we'll see next week when we look at don't go after your heart and your eyes. We do have that obligation too. Mm-hmm. That's for men and for women. So we'll end on that note. Shabbos up at Think Torah Thoughts, wherever we go and whatever we see.
So you're.